Case number 16-5196, League of Women Voters of the United States et al., appellants versus Brian D. Newby, in his capacity as the Executive Director of the United States Election Assistance Commission et al., Mr. Keats for the appellant, League of Women Voters et al., Mr. Tenney for Brian D. Newby and Commission, Mr. Kobach for Appalee, Kansas Secretary of State, and Ms. Phillips for Appalee Public Interest Legal Foundation.
Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Michael Keats of Strook and Strook and Levon. I appear for the League of Women Voters. Your Honors, the Executive Director of the U.S. Election Assistance Commission did not have authority to grant the requests of three states to require documentary proof of citizenship in connection with the federal form. The Election Assistance Commission is set up as a bipartisan commission. It has four seats. Right now, three are occupied. The intention was to have two Democrats and two Republicans. Right now we have two Republicans and one Democrat. Under the organic statute that created the commission, the Help America Vote Act, you need three commissioners to approve of a commission action. The obvious intent here is to make sure that one Democrat and at least one Republican support an action that the commission takes to ensure bipartisanship. What Mr. Newby did here was literally turn the org chart of this agency on its head and threw the entire structure of the agency out. It is undisputed that three commissioners did not approve of Mr. Newby's actions. And as a result, those actions were ultra vires. It's also undisputed that there was no delegation of authority by this commission, by three commissioners, to Mr. Newby to create, let alone change, the EAC's policy. There is no one is seriously contending that when this commission was reconstituted in 2015 with a quorum and they adopted a new management statement, that management statement delegated the authority to change the federal form, let alone to change it in a way that was contrary to prior decisions of this commission, let alone prior decisions of the FEC, let alone prior decisions of the Congress. And at the end of the day, that is the bottom line. We have an executive director who acted without authority, and under the Administrative Procedure Act, his actions must be vacated.
Counsel, even if the commission had done it itself with no more than the language used by the executive director, there still would have been the problems of explaining the decision under Fox Television.
Yes.
And also explaining why this was necessary to carry out the state substantive requirement.
I agree.
And both of those are completely missing.
Agree.
Yeah.
Agree. Yeah, no, this is administrative.
I just didn't want them to get lost in delegation.
No, and I appreciate that. Yeah, look, if you wanted to find ways to violate the Administrative Procedure Act and come up with a hypothetical for law students as to how to do it, this is a pretty good hypothetical. And at the end of the day, bottom line, that really is the case. And even the Department of Justice, which I think, understandably faced with these facts, concluded that at a minimum they had to consent to a preliminary injunction of some form to reverse this. Now, let me take a step back because this is an unusual case, and we set it up as a preliminary injunction initially. Because when these actions happened, it was back in February, and there were a series of primary elections in the various states, and obviously now we have the presidential elections. That's all by the boards. This court is a reviewing court. Even with a preliminary injunction, actually has the authority to decide this case, and you actually have the power to vacate the actions. The case that actually comes to mind is actually Judge Williams, one of your cases, a case that you released on the panel for. It was American Bioscience versus Thompson. 2001 case, 269 F3rd 1077. Well, what that case says, and that came up also on the denial of a preliminary injunction, where the judge not only found a lack of likelihood of success on the merits, but also the absence of irreparable harm. What the court said there is the entire case doctrine applies. When a district court sits in review of an agency action, it's actually a question of law. You have an administrative record. That's the record, which is what we have here when this was decided. It's been certified by the Department of Justice. And at the end of the day, if you have established entitlement to, if you have established a violation of the Administrative Procedure Act, the remedy is vacator. And I'll read some language from the case.
Not always in this circuit.
Yes, that's correct. That's correct. Not always.
And you haven't discussed that in your brief, I don't think, have you?
We've addressed that. We think that actually there is a ground for vacator here, and it's pretty clear. But I'm happy. I'm happy to address your concern. So what this court wrote here is that when a party seeks review of agency action under the APA, the district judge sits as an appellate tribunal. The entire case on review is a question of law. If an appellant has standing, and the League of Women Voters plainly has standing, which is undeniable here, and that's just a quote from the case, and prevails on its APA claim, it is entitled to relief under that statute, which normally will be a vacator of the agency's order. But whether or not appellant has suffered irreparable injury, if it makes out a case under the APA, it is entitled to a remedy. I'm not trying to tell you here that we haven't made out a case for irreparable harm. This case fundamentally involves the rights of our organizations to organize, to communicate, to engage in political speech. It involves the rights of voters to have their votes counted. And we have no doubt, and we think that there are circuits around the country that have agreed with us, that irreparable harm is established here.
What's your best formulation of the irreparable harm?
So my best formulation of the irreparable harm here is, I want to refer back to Judge Scalia's language, and it'll tie it together with what happened here. What Judge Scalia said is that the federal form, this is not about the state's election forms. They can put in what they want subject to their own laws. We're not debating that. They can do that. They are doing that. What Justice Scalia says is, states retain the flexibility to design and use their own registration forms, but the federal form provides a backstop. No matter what procedural hurdles a state's own form imposes, the federal form guarantees that a simple means of registering to vote in federal elections will be available. How is that tied into our harm? So when we go out, it is absolutely true, we try, in Kansas in particular, to register voters to vote in both state and federal elections. That means trying to help them satisfy the documentary proof of citizenship requirements that are part of the state form. But there is a group of people we find time and time again that simply lack access, ready access to those documents. Who are they? Okay? They tend to be poor. They live in rural areas. They're African American. These are the people that they're women who did nothing more than marry and change their legal name and moved out of state. None of these people has done anything wrong, okay? They have established their entitlement to U.S. citizenship within the meaning of the federal form by swearing under oath and fulfilling those elements. We use the federal form as the backstop for those people. Our core mission is to help all eligible voters to vote, not what the district court below thought was, well, your mission isn't harmed because you can help some of them to vote to register because they have documentary proof. This form was created for our organizations. The statute expressly directs state election officials to make it available to us. The entire point of the National Voter Registration Act was to promote voter participation and to help voter registration organizations like ours do this important work.
When you encounter an individual, a potential voter register in Kansas,
yes,
in a shopping center,
yes,
you still have to go through all the various possibilities of establishing citizenship, regardless of what of the outcome of this case. Isn't that correct?
No. If we want to register, get them to register in state and federal elections, yes.
Yes. Said the voter drive and the registration is for both state and federal.
Yes.
So if that's the case, then you have to go through all the Kansas requirements for citizenship proof, even if you wouldn't have to go through them for the federal.
Well, if what you're saying is we have to have that conversation, the answer is yes. But there's a further conversation to be had. If you do not have those documents, the United States Congress has created a federal form that at least allows you to vote in a federal election. So it's that backstop function, again, that Justice Scalia himself identified. You are right. We would have that conversation with him.
Also say that if, in fact, you're permitted to vote in a federal election but not permitted and not qualified to vote in a state election, that that would raise serious constitutional problems under Article 1 and the 17th Amendment?
No, that's not, with respect, I don't believe that's what he held at all. What he said was, if a state was precluded from being able to enforce its eligibility requirement, then a serious constitutional issue might arise. But happily, they didn't have to reach that, because because a state could go back to the EAC, which is the agency that has authority over the federal form. It's actually its only rulemaking authority that's binding on the states. So this is an important, central, high-profile subject for them. And you can go back and demonstrate to the EAC that you are precluded, that because of whatever, that the mere oath is not sufficient, that you are not able to actually confirm eligibility and administer your elections without that proof. And what the EAC what Congress decided, what the FEC decided afterwards, and what the EAC has consistently decided for more than a decade, is that states are precluded. Most every state in this country already accepts the federal form to register in federal and state elections. Kansas is the outlier. Kansas is almost the only state right now. I think it is the only state right now that is enforcing that requirement as a state in federal elections.
Is Louisiana enforcing its ID requirement?
I don't know if they are or they aren't. And they also, and also I think if you're referring to what the executive director referred to in her footnote, it's not clear that the AC was right in granting
that
request.
I'm referring to what the Supreme Court in the Indian case referred to in its footnote.
Yes, and we raised
also the oral argument by the Solicitor General saying that, at least implying that what Kansas or Louisiana was doing with requiring voter ID was quite all right.
Well, and I will say the EAC in their 2014 decision in a footnote says they've actually see that it actually might be wrong. They have never followed up on that, to be clear, but it is not clear that that's right, and it is different than documentary proof of citizenship. And the bottom line is, you have consistent action going back by this agent. Congress debated whether to include documentary proof. They rejected it. The FEC, when they adopted the rules that govern the federal form, considered whether to require naturalization information. They rejected it. The EAC, unanimously, a unanimous commission rejected it when they adopted those rules. The EAC, when they took over, consistently ruled against that. So the point being is, at the end of the day, it is up to the EAC to decide whether that's necessary. And then if Kansas disagrees, if they think the EAC got it wrong, what Justice Scalia said is, they can bring an APA challenge. And in fact, that's precisely what Kansas did in 2014. They went to the commission, they presented their proof, which, by the way, was very modest and was certainly less than had been shown in the Arizona case that the agencies had previously had before them. And what the executive director said there
is, has the commission ever pronounced, either by way of an adjudication, an interpretation, or less likely a rule, that the word necessary is for the commission to decide as opposed to a state?
They've not adopted a regulation that says that.
Have they adopted is there an adjudication by
yes.
the commission saying
yeah.
that?
Adjudication in the sense of, in the Administrative Procedure Act sense of an adjudication, right, which is everything that isn't done as a formal rulemaking or as a formal hearing is an adjudication. So yes, they have. The first time they did it was in 2006 when the agency decided unanimously, initially, to reject Arizona's request for documentary proof of citizenship, and there is a letter that sets forth the grounds and their understanding of necessary and who decides. That was not the first time, by the way, they took that position in 2005, facing a Florida law that wasn't documentary proof. It had to deal with whether you had to provide information about your mental well-being, among other things. They also had taken the position unanimously, it's undisputed that was unanimous, that it was for the commission to decide whether it was necessary, and they just deemed that was not necessary.
The Louisiana change was approval was by the commission.
Yes.
What interpretation, if any, did the commission give to the necessary phrase in deciding that?
Yeah, I don't know that they actually explained themselves. And as we have said, and as we pointed out to the commission, and the last word on the commission is that might actually have been wrong. I can actually get the language if you want from the commissioner's last decision. I think it's highly unlikely that is a law was a correct decision by the commission. Do you want me to get the quote because I have it? Here, give me one moment, please. I'm actually running out of time anyway. You want to stand up for my rebuttal? I'll give it to you.
I'll give it to you.
Sure, sure. I've got 15 seconds left. Look, thank you. The most important thing I can urge you is the election. The registration deadlines are fast approaching, October 12th, October 19th, October 29th. I understand what that means for this appellate court. I understand what we're asking. I understand how fast we're asking you to act. It is not likely that we're asking you to do this, but given the gravity of the harm to voters and to our organizations, we urge that you do so. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning.
May it please the court, as we indicated in our brief,
maybe you should identify yourself.
I'm sorry, Daniel Tenney for the government. We are not defending the decision that's at issue here on the single ground that it doesn't comply with the statutory standard, especially as explicated by the Supreme Court in the Intertribal Council case, and that is the ground on which we are suggesting that the court could resolve this case. You know, in these unusual circumstances where we're not defending the agency decision that's at issue, we're content to rest on our briefs. If the court does have questions, I'm prepared to entertain them.
Why do you think the leaks have demonstrated irreparable harm? You haven't mentioned that hardly in your brief, have you? Except that you agreed in the district court. That's it.
Right. We agree. The leagues are conducting voter registration activities contemplated as counsel discussed by the statute, and they have affidavits suggesting that they want to use this federal form to register voters, and that it's made more difficult to do that. And the district court accepted that and said that they had standing for that reason. And given the nature of registration drives and that every day they're trying to register more people, we thought that that harm would be irreparable unless it was
cured. Has the change actually been made on the Kansas for one thing? Has the change been made on the website?
The change has been made on the federal form. Yes, in all three states. Yes, Your Honor.
But Alabama and Georgia are not enforcing their requirement?
The record suggests that yes, they. So apparently, if you disregard the instructions on the form and send in a form that does not include documentary proof of citizenship in those two states, they will still register you to vote, according to the district court record.
And the district court record includes representations from who in those states?
I apologize. I don't recall exactly. The parties didn't, as I remember, dispute that was the case. I'm just saying that because I don't want to be suggesting to you that I have, you know, separate. I can separately confirm that. I'm just going based on what the parties seem to understand and the district judge seemed to understand in the district court. Unless there are further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
All right, counsel for intervener, the Kansas Secretary of State.
Thank you, and may it please the court. I'm Chris Kobach, representing the state of Kansas, Office of the Secretary of State. If, with the court's leave, I'd like to just very quickly hit three factual issues that are, I think there's no dispute about, that they're important to understand, then get into the arguments already made. Number one, since the creation of the federal form, virtually all of the state-specific instructions have been approved, and the vast majority of those by the executive director alone, without any action by the commission. Now, the Supreme Court correctly described this as a, quote, entirely informal, end quote, process. In the state of Kansas's experience, we would simply send a letter, and then their change would be made without any explanation of why the change was made, why our request was granted. Other states would send email, although we relied on letters. And never prior to Mr. Newby's recent case, in this about which we are talking now, never was any acceptance ever explained. When the EAC granted a state request to change the instructions, it was just made without any explanation. Second factual issue, in this recent request, November...
None of those was litigated, right?
Correctly. Yeah, that's correct. Although, yeah, the only other litigation was regarding denials. In November 2015, Kansas requested the instructions we're talking about now. There are three significant differences between these instructions and the 2013 request by Kansas in Arizona. One, the new instructions include a 90-day limit that is part of a new Kansas regulation. You have 90 days to provide your proof of citizenship. You can email it in, fax it in, whatever.
There's a reference to a suspension list in connection with that 90-day.
The suspense file is the term of art that our system uses. It just means that once you've provided your registration form, your registration is held in suspense until you finish it by providing proof of citizenship.
Are the names of the persons who are on the suspense list, is that maintained in a computer file?
Yes, and actually, so we have our statewide voter registration database. You could be active, which means you've completed your registration, inactive, meaning that you may have moved out of the state, inactive is you haven't voted recently. We have reason to believe you've moved out of the state, and we're in the process of potentially removing you if we confirm that. And then suspense could be any number of reasons. It might be that you're a 17-year-old who hasn't turned 18.
Are the Browns on that list?
The Browns are in a separate category, and they are, it's important to note
The answer to my question is no?
They are, I believe they are not in the suspense list. Well, their registration is incomplete, but we have a separate list for this 180 people who used the federal form prior to the change of instructions on February 1st.
Are they receiving 90-day notices?
No. They are being given all of the benefit of as if the federal form was never changed per our request, and so they are allowed to vote in federal. They're fully registered for federal elections. They cannot
vote. Who has the authority to bind the state of Kansas so that no challenge can be made to the eligibility of the Browns to vote in the federal and state elections?
I'm not sure I understand your question, but
it's very clear.
Who has the authority to bind the state of Kansas?
Yes.
Well, obviously an Article III court would have the authority to bind the state of Kansas. The EAC has the authority only to modify the wording of the federal form.
The state of Kansas has that authority?
Oh, the Kansas law is applied by the Secretary of State's office and by the counties. And so the counties are the ones who go in and change the status of any individual voter. The Secretary of State determines statewide voter policies and registrations, both rules and statute, if approved by the legislature.
Is it your representation that if the Browns vote in whatever elections, federal and state, that there can be no challenge to their eligibility?
Under state law, we treat them as eligible to vote in federal elections. Because
so the Kansas would concede in any litigation that the Browns are fully eligible to vote?
In federal elections only. The Browns, it's important, this court's decision will have no effect on the Browns. It's very important to note they registered prior to February 1st.
Well, I think the record is unclear. All right, that's why I'm trying
In their reply, if you're talking about what they asserted in the reply, that is false. They asserted that the Browns are not on any registration roll. What they did is they made a public request for the list of all active voters. The Browns are in the special roll of 180-some people who used the federal form prior to it being changed on the federal 1st. So that one, if you remember the public, you walk into your county clerk's office, you're not going to get that roll. But they did vote, and they voted in the
So the change in the federal form was not retroactive. People that
correct. We are treating those people. It's not retroactive.
Is it correct that the federal form really only deals with people who have not been previously registered?
As a practical matter, yes. You wouldn't if you're already registered. We had a grandfather clause, so you didn't have to prove your citizenship. If I might just quickly go to a couple more factual matters that may help the court.
The litigation in state court involving the Browns.
Yes.
Has Kansas conceded error?
No, not at all. The question in district court is in state district court is this: does the state have the authority to bifurcate the election and say this voter can vote in federal elections only and this voter can't?
E.g., what you have described as to the Browns.
Correct. And there's only been a TRO judgment. We have a preliminary injunction hearing on September 21st. We're a long way from summary judgment, and so the decision with respect to the Browns is, do we have the authority to say you can vote in federal elections only? The court said no on TRO, that the Secretary of State didn't have authority under Kansas statute, that the statute wasn't specific enough. We argue that no, the statute does give me the authority to take any steps necessary to comply with the NVRA, and because this is an NVRA issue. But no, that decision is far from, we've only had a TRO judgment at that point. We have a hearing on September 21st. Let's just jump to irreparable harm. The leagues have failed to establish, and contrary to their reply brief, the wording of the federal form in no way bars the plaintiffs from engaging in First Amendment protected registration activities. Their only real...
It's barred. But the question is whether...
Is it inhibit?
It need not be a bar.
It's
an impediment.
It's not even an impediment, Your Honor.
Doesn't it require the leagues to incur expenses and engage in activities that add to the difficulty of getting potential voters registered?
What it does is it forces them to change the content of their educational materials. The materials say, well, if you use a federal form, this happens. Now they have to say, if you use a federal form, this happens. But they are producing materials of about $13,000.
I mean, there are cases on the significance of a mere change, but this is a change which clearly adds to the task to be performed to get someone registered.
I think on the contrary, and we put this point in our brief, it simplifies things. Before the federal form was changed, they had to explain to a confused voter, well, why does the federal form have a different requirement regarding citizenship than the state form? Now that the EAC has made the change, federal form and state forms are the same. It's easier to explain to the voters. And as Judge Leon noted, the amount of material they produce is the same.
I mean, isn't it, from what you've just said, it seems clear that it makes it more difficult to get voters registered for the federal election.
The proof of citizenship requirement in and of itself adds another step. We do not concede that it makes it more difficult. 94% of the people who have started the process have completed the process.
Right.
And many of the ones who haven't have moved out of the state.
The fact that a large number of people get over a hurdle does not mean that it was not a hurdle.
Well, and then, Your Honor, we have to fall. That's their fallback harm. So if their first harm is, well, we just changed the wording of our materials, now the fallback harm is, well, we're not as successful registering people because we have this proof of citizenship requirement. Two problems with that.
Another one has to look at degree of success.
Let's just assume.
An additional hurdle.
Let's assume that it's a very big additional hurdle. Give all the benefit to them. Still, it is speculative, and this is what the district court correctly noted. It is speculative whether somebody is going to fail or succeed based on the change they have in the way they approach these voters and give them information. And secondly, even if it were not speculative, if it were certain...
Seems to me, I mean, if you're talking about hundreds of people being having the registration process facilitated by the leagues, and all of them are now required to produce documentary proof of citizenship, it seems to be hardly speculative to say that it's likely to reduce the quantity of registration.
It is speculation when you say it is likely, Your Honor, with respect. I mean, you're saying it's very likely. It might be.
Yeah, but irreparable harm has never required absolute certainty.
But then let's assume it is absolutely certain. Then this court would have to disagree with the Sixth Circuit, which says the plaintiffs are organizations and cannot vote. Instead, they assert the right to vote of individuals not even presently identifiable. So then they have this problem of they're claiming harm to a hypothetical individual who hypothetically is unable to complete the registration process in time. For irreparable harm purposes, they can't.
They're actually claiming harm to the achievement of their mission, which involves facilitating potential voters actually getting themselves registered.
That they are. But the Sixth Circuit has ruled, and I think it makes sense, that you can't claim as part of your mission my independent decision or your independent decision to register or not register. That is a separate decision that they can't say, we have as an organization have an interest in making sure that Judge William registers whether he knows he needs to or not. We're going to persuade him.
I think you're misformulating what the leagues posit as their goal, namely to facilitate registration by people who are included.
And then let's go to that final point. What they, by their own declaration, say is their goal, as Judge Randolph noted, is that you register for both state and federal elections. And to the extent that they use a federal form that suggests that you need not provide proof of citizenship, they undermine their own goal, and these people do not get registered for state elections.
leaders think they're able to, they're entitled to make priorities among their goals?
By their own admission, their goal is to register people for both federal and state.
But their declarations also make clear that getting people registered for the federal elections is an independent goal, and it appears, at least in this context, to be one that they regard as independently important.
I would like to suggest here that the attitude of the attorneys may not reflect the attitude of their clients. In a deposition for a related case, the Fish case, and they grouse about this in a footnote in their reply, the representative of the Kansas League of Women Voters made very clear that we want them vote registered. It is of utmost importance they vote in Kansas elections, not just federal elections. But let me jump to some important points on the merits.
Well, and you're overlooking other declarations indicating the decrease in the number of persons actually registered. So those are not speculative. Those are facts in this record.
You're talking about in their registration drives, they assert that we didn't register as many people in this drive as we did in last year's drive. The actual registration tallies for the state of Kansas indicate that we have set an all-time record this past August in the number of people registered prior to a presidential year primary.
Well, you are, but they're, is not the league.
Right, but they're asserting, well, we think last year's drive was more successful. But, of course, there are thousands of reasons why one drive may have been more successful, location, time, whether that it is simply a far-fetched assertion to say, well, and it was the change in the federal form, which now makes it simpler to explain things to voters. But let me go to the merits, and this is one thing that hasn't been discussed yet, and I think it is of decisive importance. The executive director's decision was compelled by federal rule. The FEC promulgated a rule mandating that the federal form, quote, shall list U.S. citizenship as a universal eligibility requirement and include a statement that incorporates by reference each state's specific additional eligibility requirements.
But this is not an eligibility requirement. This is simply a means of demonstrating.
And I anticipated you might ask that. The
right.
same rule
so
has
I
another section.
Why you even focused on that.
Well, that maybe, and I apologize. There's two sections of the rule. We put one in the brief proper and one in the addendum. Please look on page 5 of our addendum where you will find 9428.3b. 9428.3b of the same rule. It says, the state-specific instruction shall contain the following information regarding the state's specific voter eligibility and registration requirements. So not just eligibility requirements like citizenship or whatever you, how you want to define those, but registration requirements as well. That's 9428.3b on page 5 of our addendum. In both cases, the rule promulgated by the predecessor of the EAC, the FEC, use the word shall, and they use the word shall intentionally. Now, the appellant leagues, and Mr. Newby, by the way, his behavior and his decision, and he did articulate a rationale for his decision, which is in the administrative record, both on page 1 and then his declaration on page 242. He is perfectly consistent with this rule. He says the states have changed their law. I am supposed to make an according change when requested in the state-specific instructions. Now, the appellant...
Is it consistent with the statute?
Absolutely. And this is another point.
But how can that be when he says the statutory reference is irrelevant? And you and your brief make an argument about context and reading and all that sort of thing. But the commission seems to have been pretty clear about that.
The statute has two parts, and that's something that the leagues actually physically omit in their brief. They continue to put an ellipsis about the part they don't want you to read. And the statute says, right after the word necessary, such information as is necessary to enable the appropriate state election official, one, to assess the eligibility of the applicant, and here's the part they omit, and two, to administer voter registration and other parts of the election process.
And you want us to read and as or?
I think that's the most reasonable reading of it, because there are some things...
Congress chose the word and.
The reason it's most reasonable is there's lots of information in the state-specific instructions that include things like, here's the address of the office. Well, the address of the office doesn't assess eligibility. Here are the dates by which you need to do things. Those don't assess eligibility of the applicant. Those are things that are needed to administer the voter registration process. So it has to be read as an or, because there's so much that doesn't go to the eligibility of the applicant that is included in the state-specific instructions. And so the statutory interpretation that he offers when he says, well, it's irrelevant whether I think proof of citizenship is the best way and is necessary in a subjective way to assess eligibility in terms of citizenship. What is relevant is the second part of that statute. Again, this is 20508B1, to administer voter registration and other parts of the election process.
Can you take me through? I was late in getting to your addendum, but I'm looking at it now. And just briefly, give me the argument that you've just made from the...
Yes.
You said addendum page 5.
Page 5, yeah. So there,
is it 5 or 6?
It might be 6, Your Honor. It's 20508, B1 is the first one that we quote, and then the other part of it is 20508C.
B is on page 6, right?
Let me just check with my co-counsel who's got it. The other. It might be point 4. We'll check the addendum real quick. But the language that you'll find that I'm referring to is...
Well, we have the statute on page 6. On page 5 are the regulations that you say the Federal Election Commission initially promulgated, right?
Yes.
Okay, so what is it on? Is it 9428.4 that you're referring to?
It's addendum page 6. You are correct, it's page 6. And it's right at the bottom of the two-thirds down the page. Specify each eligibility requirement. Shall list U.S. citizenship as eligibility requirement and include a statement that incorporates by reference each additional eligibility requirement. And then that's the first one. And then the second one is 11 CFR 9428.3B, which is found...
Point 3B, okay. I've got it's on page.
It's, oh, it is found on page 5. Here we go. It's right on page 5 in the middle of the page, paragraph B. The state-specific instructions shall contain the following information for each state arranged by state. Address, ... information regarding the state's specific voter eligibility and registration requirements. So that's found on page 5 of our addendum, right in the middle of the page. And
How does that answer Judge Rogers' question about whether proof of citizenship, documentary proof of citizenship, is an eligibility requirement or just simply a means of proving eligibility?
Because that second language says both the eligibility requirements and the mere registration requirements. I think she's drawing a distinction between maybe citizenship is just the eligibility requirement and that's enough. But the registration requirement is proof of citizenship.
So in other words, specific voter eligibility and registration requirement.
Yeah, exactly.
And the proof of citizenship is a registration requirement if it's not an eligibility requirement.
Right. We think it's both. I think everybody concedes it's a registration requirement.
This is probably not the right question to ask you, but if you know, it would clear something up for me. When did the commission reduce to 3 members as opposed to 4?
It still is 4 members. The Congress just hasn't finished confirming the empty spots on the commission.
Well, that means...
But it makes things difficult because the statute requires 3 votes to do anything. And so you have a 3-member commission that has to be unanimous to do anything. And
what is the record with regard to the commission's reaction to Mr. Newby's decision?
There has been no reaction.
I thought one member of the commission said... We need to vote on this. So he didn't have 3 votes. Is that correct?
Right, he didn't have 3 votes. And that's a great question because, look, the commission at any time could sua sponte reverse his decision on their own.
Again, I'm asking the wrong person, but Mr. Tenney, I hope you pay attention to this question because I'm going to ask you in rebuttal. Mr. Newby is a defendant in this case, and Mr. Newby is the one who made this decision. So we can put him... How can the Department of Justice represent a commission opinion if the commission acts only with 3 votes?
The commission didn't act here at all, and I think plaintiffs have been playing a little fast and loose with their words of unanimously did this or that.
I'm just wondering about the Department of Justice's representation of a commission that is required when it makes a policy decision to have three votes. If the commission believed that, unanimously believed that Mr. Newby violated his role in this case, which is what the Department of Justice is representing to us, it's the case shouldn't be here. The commission tomorrow could render a decision and just say that's wrong.
Exactly.
And he's our executive director. We're responsible for supervising him.
That's exactly right.
And but if the commission can't do that because it only has two members believing that or one member believing that, I don't understand how the Department of Justice can stand up here and represent the commission's position to us.
That's exactly right, and that's what I wanted to end on. There is no policy. There has never been a vote of three commissioners saying it is our policy to reject proof of citizenship.
Well,
never.
In fairness, if you go back to the beginning, that's not correct.
Which beginning, Your Honor?
205, 206. We even have the executive director in 2012 after when there were no commissioners.
But in 05, and this
so
is where their brief is deceptive.
My point is that Mr. Newby's explanation of his action is this is not a change in policy. This is just, I'm looking for, what did he call it, correctness and proficiency, something like that. So he didn't make any reference to the statute. He didn't make any reference to what the commission has previously said. This is his interpretation.
It's so important that I think right. You understand, but the brief was a little, I don't know if it was intentional or not, deceptive on this. In 2006, the commission did not unanimously, that's their word, did not unanimously reject Arizona's decision. The executive director unilaterally rejected it. There was no commission vote, and then Arizona appealed to the full commission, and the full commission deadlocked 2-2. So I think the word unanimously is deceptive, whether it's intentional or not, and I think that is a fair statement. There has never been a vote by three commissioners ever saying that proof of citizenship is a criterion or an eligibility requirement that we reject. Never. And there was no commission vote in 2013-14 because there were no commissioners. So that's why all of their discussion of this reversal of policy makes no sense, because the commission never had three members adopting such a policy.
And what about all the legislative history, Congress's rejection, the FEC's rejection, all of that the executive director is free to ignore?
The legislative history, and we explain this to some extent in our brief, Senator Alan Simpson offered an interpretive amendment that said we should not interpret this law to prevent any state from requiring proof of citizenship. Then the principal sponsor of the NVRA in the Senate said that is unnecessary because the language cannot be interpreted to bar a state from providing proof of citizenship. And so the subsequent
not
committee...
particularly accurate counsel.
Wendell Ford is the person I'm talking about. Wendell Ford is the one who said it would be redundant, I think was the word he used, because the statute cannot be read.
I'm looking at a conference committee report.
And then the
in any event, those words speak for themselves. Do you
yes,
have anything do. Else to argue?
Your Honor, the last point I just wanted to briefly touch on was the constitutional doubt. The ITCA decision says very clearly that not only can we avoid constitutional doubt by just sending it to the EAC with the expectation that the EAC would not put an impediment to enforcing the registration requirement of citizenship, and that's what this is. This is an enforcement mechanism to citizenship. But also, by extension, was the words the ITCA court used, the EAC should also accept the request and not create an impediment to enforcing the registration requirement, because if they did create an impediment, that would raise constitutional doubt by violating Article 1, Section 2, because a state would be unable to enforce their citizenship qualification as they see fit, and you would have separate qualifications for state and federal elections, which is the situation that resulted prior to the February 1st change. So you add all of these factors together, the regulation compelling Newby to do so, the very permissive standard that applies in cases like this, the statute with the second half, the reason why something might be necessary, and the ITCA decision, an expectation that the EAC would, the second time around, say yes, Mr. Newby's decision can be defended on multiple grounds.
And one last question for me. How many people are on this suspension list in Kansas, including the special category that you say the Browns are in?
Right, the special category of people who use the federal form prior to the change in the federal form.
How many people are in that category?
That's, I believe, 181 or 182.
Right. How many people are in the suspension?
The overall suspension list is people who are whose registrations haven't been completed, and that list changes every day because people complete them every day. And
I understand.
It's approximately 17,000, and it's important to note.
Where can I find that in the record somewhere?
I don't think it's in the record because it changes every day. If you look at the declarations of Mr. Kasky from our side.
It's gone from, 16,000 up to 25,000, and now you're representing today.
It's about 17,000, yeah.
All these people are leaving the state of Kansas.
Well, no, as soon as you provide your proof of citizenship by texting it in or emailing it in, you come off the list. You have completed your registration. You are no longer in suspense. But if your brother comes in today and registers to vote but doesn't provide proof of citizenship, he goes on.
You're making representations about what happened to these people that simply are not in the record.
The ones that are not in the special category of 181,
I'm talking about what you represent today is 17,000.
You'll see a Kasky exhibit from our office, and he gave the number on the date of that declaration.
Right.
But we don't have to. If you wish, we can certainly update the court with numbers, the most recent number, even today's number, if you wish.
It's hard to know what these numbers represent. That's the
problem. They just represent the people that are in that flux. They come in, you register, you haven't provided.
Means. Yeah.
Those are people who have filled out a card but haven't yet provided proof of citizenship.
Mm.
They've got 90 days to do it, and the number changes every day.
And after 90,
Kansas has procedure, doesn't it, which you haven't mentioned.
Yes.
For people who don't have documentary.
If you don't have any of the documents, you just request an informal hearing, and it's usually done by phone, of the state election board. And in that hearing, you can provide whatever you want. And there have been four of them so far, and all four cases, the citizenship has been approved. People have provided family Bibles that have the names of their birth on it, school records. They're usually extraordinary cases where somebody was in foster care and their birth certificate was in a fire, and they can't get for whatever reason, they can't find the documents. But in every case, they provide other affidavit from your brother saying.
Just by a telephone call.
Just by a telephone call.
So how big is this office?
The Secretary of State's office?
Well, you're saying I can just make a telephone
call. Oh, you call the Secretary of State's office. The Secretary of State's office then convenes a meeting of these three people, of which I am one. And the usually the meetings are done telephonically. You send in, you fax in whatever you want.
17,000 of these before the next election. I just want to understand
really
what's going on here.
The vast majority of the 17,000
come off. In other words, this is not what a number of states have done, where they have provided an alternative to meeting this method of proof. Kansas is still requiring.
No, we provide an alternative, and the alternative is you give us whatever you want, a declaration from your aunt saying you were born on a certain day and born in the United States. That's enough. So the alternative, and it's important to note, the vast majority of the 17,000, and I'm talking overwhelming majority, will go on and come off within a 30-day period. They're just there temporarily until they find their passport or their birth certificate and fax it in.
If they have them.
And if they don't have them, again, they can use that alternative mechanism. But at this point, bear in mind, nobody has challenged the constitutionality of our law, the proof of citizenship requirement.
I understand, but Congress has passed a statute that says you mail in this form and you can attest, and if the state wants to challenge it, they can prosecute you. And that's what states do, and indeed, that's what the executive director pointed to, it's what the Tenth Circuit pointed to. You have all these other means as well.
Right, and as we pointed out in our letter to the EAC requesting this, that all of those other means have failed in Kansas. The reason you can't prosecute someone who's a non-citizen is because by the time you learn that they're not citizens, they were on the rolls, the statute of limitations has run.
Your representation today that they have failed, I don't know how you can make that representation. We don't know how many cases were brought. We don't know how many cases could have been brought. We don't know what happened to those cases. So to represent
actually,
that when you have it on the books and other means have worked, according to the Tenth Circuit, according to the executive director of the commission.
The Tenth Circuit didn't say that the other five means have worked. They said the state hasn't proven that they haven't. And on the record, you will find the cases of 18 aliens in one county alone of our 105 counties in Sedgwick County.
No, but Mr. Newby didn't rely on that at all.
He did mention it, either in his declaration or in his memorandum. Is it one or the other?
In his decisions and his, quote, contemporaneous.
He talked about the new evidence that Kansas has provided.
I can't remember, but the Seventh Circuit recently came down with a per curiam opinion dealing with a change in Wisconsin law. Are you familiar with that case?
It was like about
a week ago, I think it was.
I haven't read the decision, but I believe that's their photo ID law, which is a different challenge. It was not a proof of citizenship.
Photo.
Yeah. If there are no further questions, thank you.
Great, thank you. All right. Let's see. Intervenor Public Interest Legal Foundation. Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Kaylin Phillips, and I'm here on behalf of Appellee Intervenor Public Interest Legal Foundation. Non-citizen voting is a serious problem in the United States, a problem that Kansas, Georgia, and Alabama have done something about.
And your proof of this is what?
We actually provided on the record, we provided several key pieces of evidence, including 13 forms from one county in Texas where the applicants either checked no to the citizenship checkbox or left it blank or checked yes and no, and their registration was still processed.
And the courts have viewed this as a minimal showing. At least the courts in these states
have viewed the proof of citizenship attestations.
I mean, 13, 18.
I assert that even one evidence of non-citizen voting is sufficient, but these are only mere examples that we've provided. We've also provided.
Well, you made this broad statement about voter fraud.
Yes.
Major concern in these three states, and I just wondered what the evidence was, that's all.
Sure, yes.
Since there have been all these books and articles written saying it isn't. In any event, that's your organization's position. And your organization is saying your mission is being inhibited because?
Our mission is the promotion of election integrity, and therefore non-citizen voting is directly contrary to our mission.
So one voter fraud case is sufficient, in your view, to establish an inhibition to your mission?
Well, that's not even where we are. Kansas alone provided 18.
How about that question, answering that question?
Yes, I would say yes.
All right,
I would say yes. I said this is very, and I submit that this is a very serious problem with more than one example.
So from the league's point of view, taking that logic, the failure to register one voter is an impediment to the establishment of their mission.
I think that goes more to standing, if that's
well, what... I asked you the question about how does this interfere with your mission, and you said one voter fraud was enough.
Certainly, and I would let them speak to their mission, but that's what they've submitted to the court, that is their goal is to register voters. And our submission is that their goals are not impeded by what the Election Assistance Commission has done. In fact, they are facilitated. Because in Kansas, for example, the federal form now reflects accurately the state qualifications for voting. But
let me ask, what happens in Alabama and Georgia? I'm just not clear. I go to register to vote, and I'm told, well, Alabama's not enforcing this documentary requirement now, so we're going to register you. Has the state legislature said that? Has the attorney general said that? Has the secretary of state said that? Because what's to stop somebody from challenging my vote after the election because I didn't comply with the state requirements that are listed as part of the federal form?
Certainly, and there's certainly nothing on the record that says that any voter has been challenged for that reason, for failure.
Well, we haven't had the election yet.
It's true, but we have had primary elections since the addition of the
I'm just not clear what the status is in those two states. I mean, the representation is those states aren't enforcing these requirements. What does that mean?
You know, actually,
and who's making those representations?
You're
concerned about election integrity.
Yes, yes, ma'am. Yes, and that your point goes to the broader picture, the tree that I think has been lost in the forest here, which is that the district court is hearing a motion on summary judgment on Monday. This case has been fully briefed. More evidence has been provided to the district court than has been provided here. And under this circuit's law, it is prudent for this court, even if you find that there's irreparable harm, which we submit there's not, even if you find that there is, the proper course of action, the prudent course of action, is to send it back down to the district court. The district court did not address any of the other factors, including likelihood of success. So therefore, I think that's something that's been missing here, that the only inquiry here is irreparable harm. And more than that, there are those factual questions about enforcement. The district court found that the law was not being enforced in Alabama and Georgia, and therefore there was no irreparable harm. And then as to Kansas, found that the state law has been in effect since 2013. So therefore, it simplifies the process for the leagues, because now, in one step, they can register voters for both state and federal.
Are you suggesting that if the district court renders a decision, let's say on Monday after the hearing, denying summary judgment, are there cross motions, I guess?
Yeah, there are. Or
granting summary judgment for you as intervener in Kansas, that this case becomes moot?
I am.
Yeah, because the where we are now is preliminary injunction means preliminary to the final decision of the district court.
Yes.
And if there is a final decision of the district court, then there's nothing preliminary left to decide.
Correct. Okay. Yes, and the fact that that case has now been expedited also, with briefing as complete, argument in this very building in 3 days, then it is even more prudent for this court not to address those issues that the district court will be addressing. I see that my time is up.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Counsel for appellant.
Hi, thank you. So, let me just take a few points here in no particular order. One, the ITCA case clearly held that there has to be a finding of necessity within the meaning of the statute. The Secretary's reliance on a regulation that he would read as essentially contradicting the statute and also ignoring it. You can't get through the back door where you couldn't get through the front. And that's really what that is an attempt at. Nobody's interpreted that regulation, not even Mr. Newby, the way Mr. Kobach suggested it. And we submit it would be a violation of the NVRA and the Supreme Court's ITCA case to read it that way. I don't have anything else to say on that subject. With respect to this notion that there's no policy, the word policy is actually being misused here. The point is there is a long-standing precedent by, as we've said, Congress and the regulatory agencies that have had authority over this to reject documentary proof. And I wanted to address the point you raised, which is this 2-to-1 thing. Why can't the commission just decide? The issue is, as Justice Scalia recognized in the ITCA case.
Well, that wasn't my point, but go ahead.
Yeah, I understand. This isn't a question about overruling the executive director. He didn't have authority to begin with. Okay, that's the premise. So the way to think of it is you have to get 3 votes to effectively abandon what he did. That's not the law, and Justice Scalia made it pretty clear that what happens here is if you don't get 3 votes, the result is no action is taken. It's not that no action is taken on what the executive director did. It's no action is taken on what was proposed by the state. So it's not as if I can't explain why the EAC hasn't addressed this.
My point was the Department of Justice has taken a position in this court that Mr. Newby acted unlawfully.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Okay. And they're making that representation on behalf of the commission, and yet you're making the argument the commission can't make a decision unless it's by three votes.
Yes.
And my point was, well, if the commission made a decision that the Department of Justice is correct and allowed them to file this brief, why can't the commission just simply issue an order to that effect and end this case? And then, you know, Kansas can bring it up if they want or not.
Yeah, I mean, look, I can't.
I know you
that.
Can't answer.
Yeah, I can't answer that. I wish I could. It would make all of our lives easier.
That was my question.
I understand. But it should.
It's not an unfamiliar problem with these election commissions.
No, correct. That's right. And they're intended to be this way. It's intended for this to be. So let me talk about a couple of other topics. One, I wanted to give you the site. A judge that I promised, which is it's the 2014 memorandum decision, page 44, footnote 26, where we raised this actually as part of that process. And what they say is the EAC will consider the issues that we've raised. After consulting with Louisiana officials, the commission will consider whether there are necessary and appropriate modifications in item 6 of the state-specific instructions for Louisiana on the federal form to clarify any lingering confusion and to ensure the instruction is in full compliance with requirements of HAVA relating to federal elections.
It sounds like they expressed doubt about the validity of the Louisiana decision.
That's how I read it, but I invite you to read it yourself and form your own judgment. The timing, this notion that the judge has tried to get out ahead of you below by setting forth a summary judgment schedule. We have elections coming up. We have deadlines in a little over a month. We have no guarantee of when the court will rule or what he will rule. But as I pointed out, there is authority in this circuit, which says at this point, we have an administrative record. It's closed. It is what it is. And this court has the ability now to decide this and to vacate. We don't have time, unfortunately, to go back. We brought this case early. We brought it as a PI. And unfortunately, the court delayed in responding. And he may have had good reasons to delay. But the bottom line is we didn't get an opinion until we wrote and asked him for one. And we are now finding ourselves on the eve of an election, and we really need to have this resolved. And sending it back to the court and sending it, we'll just be right back here when this court already has the power to decide this. Last point I want to make. You mentioned that this process, all it is a phone call to the Secretary of State.
I didn't mention that.
Oh, okay. But I want to address that point.
I
it seems like.
Question, how do
yeah,
you go about it?
Fair enough. That's a very burdensome approach, right? When we do a voter registration drive, we can't just have him on speed dial and have a conference call. He's only done 4 of these things in 3 years. Try to get a Secretary of State on the phone in the middle of a voter registration drive to do this. And at the end of the day, the notion that you can do that by phone, I assume it's under oath, I don't know if it's under oath, that's exactly what the federal form does. It has someone prescribe under oath that they are a citizen. And more importantly, well, you may agree, we all may agree or disagree, whatever, about the validity of these laws, it's not an issue. The bottom line is Congress has spoken, and the agency that is charged with addressing these issues has consistently rejected it. The notion that there isn't a policy, I want to focus on one thing, because counsel suggested I misrepresented something. I did not. This commission, in its early days, did everything by consensus, because that was the spirit in which this was passed, this was created. It was a bipartisan commission. It was HAVA was passed with enormous bipartisan support following the 2000 elections. And they had a practice, which you can see in the record, it's part of the record, that even says, and this is actually one of the opinions that came out in 06, after careful analysis, the EAC's general counsel, with the unanimous support of EAC commissioners, issued a determination to Florida, this is that early one, which upheld the 13-year president of the NVRA, that the federal form as promulgated by the EAC must be unconditionally used and accepted by all NVRA jurisdictions. I cite it because it shows that there was that practice of informally agreeing. You don't need to have a vote under the statute. What the statute says, you need 3 commissioners to approve. That's important. There was no requirement of an on-the-record vote. The only reason that became an on-the-record vote is that Arizona approached the chairman at the time, and said, we need an accommodation because we're in the middle of a litigation. That's why they wound up being an on-the-record vote. But historically, they had actually done this precisely this way. There was no misrepresentation at all. But let's talk about one misrepresentation I do want to address, the notion of the Browns being registered. They are not registered in any meaningful sense in Kansas law. What they're allowed to do is to vote at the pleasure of the Secretary of State. They receive provisional ballots for the August 3rd primary, which the Secretary of State, in his good grace, decided to let them cast, and they were allowed to vote in a federal election. He may do that on November 8th, okay? There's nothing that binds him to do that. And frankly, in the litigation that they've been having in other courts, there have been suggestions more categorically that he wants to reserve the rights as to what to do with those people. And that is not, that, this is exactly the kind of procedural hurdles that Congress tried to avoid, at least for federal elections. It's why the NVRA was passed. It's why we have the federal form. And the notion that this is speculative harm, this is coming from the Secretary's own brief. Okay, this isn't, I didn't come up with this number. This is not my number. This is in his brief, page 56. What he says is that Kansas has accepted 62,992 applications to register to vote from the date, which is February 1st, to present, of which 11,655 were mail-in applications that may have been on a federal form. Okay? That is an extraordinary number. By any means, that is mass disenfranchisement. This court has the power and the opportunity to do something really important here, which is to prevent these people from being disenfranchised.
Under Kansas law, you have 90 days to provide proof of citizenship. So if you mail your registration form in without it, you're on a waiting list with 90 days to provide. So that's a constant flux. That list is constantly changing. And some people may never provide it because they move out of state, or they die, or they decide they don't want to rent. They don't want to vote.
Judge, this isn't my number. This is their number. It's all I'm saying. It's what he put in a brief, and he chose to put it in a brief.
It's not mass disenfranchisement, though.
If that isn't mass disenfranchisement with respect, Judge, I don't know what is. But even one voter that'd be disenfranchised would be too much, given the strength of which Congress has spoken here.
All right.
Thank you.
Did you want to hear from Mr. Tinney?
Yeah.
All right. Counsel, thank you. Counsel for the department, or for the commission, Mr. Tinney, where are you seated? Thank you.
You heard my question. I don't want to repeat it for the third time. Do you have any response?
The brief that we filed in this court was filed by the Department of Justice, which has authority to represent the commission. The commission does not have independent litigating authority in the federal courts, and so the representations that are made in the brief are representations from the department.
Now, wait a minute. If you are representing a commission, and I read your brief, I'm not reading the Department of Justice's policy position. I'm supposedly reading the commission's policy position. And the department in the civil division or the Solicitor General's office has meetings with the general counsel of the various commissions to decide exactly what their position is on these things. So you're telling me that what we have here is not the commission's position, it's the Department of Justice's position, and the Department of Justice is not a party to this case. This brief is not the commission's position.
Just to be clear, we're not talking about policy positions. We're talking about legal positions, and there are legal positions.
A legal position can't be a policy position?
It could. I guess I just want to make clear.
You've represented that Mr. Newby acted illegally.
That the Department of Justice is charged by federal statute with representing the commission in court.
I know that. And that doesn't say that the Department of Justice gives its views regardless of what the commission or the agency's views are.
Well, I wouldn't say regardless of what the agency's views are, Your Honor, but the Department of Justice has an obligation to the court if the agency's decision is irreconcilable with governing law, as the department concluded it was in this case. The Department of Justice sets out the government's position, and that is what we've done here, and I hope that at least now I've been clear about what it is that we are saying in our brief.
Thank you. We will take this case under advisement.